Hello. Welcome to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where the term flea flicker makes us want to go to the vet. I am delighted today to be joined by I was going to say old friend, Warren, but we're not that old friends, but you are a repeat guest of this. Is this your second appearance or third?
It's my second. We did the first one. Well, actually, you're right. Maybe there is a third one, but definitely the last one we did was live in person up in Boston.
Right. Yes. And you are the superstar of football nerd Twitter, which has been very active, which is why we will be having a two-hour discussion today on whether running backs. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to do that. I swear we're not going to do that. Although, I will say, Warren, one of the teams we are talking about today, I think, is really, I think, a compelling jumping-off point for that discussion in some ways, and that's New England, because we are doing the AFC East, which is the last division in the division previews. And you can read about sort of these teams and really all the teams in Warren's 2019 football preview, which I highly recommend. You can get it at sharpfootballanalysis.com. You can follow Warren at sharpfootball. Warren, are you excited to talk about the AFC East?
I am. I'm excited to talk about any division, any team. You know, there's a lot of compelling research that we've generated over this off season, you know, nuggets and things that people probably don't know about these teams. So every division is interesting. I hope that the future of the AFC East is better than the past. It's boring when there's not a lot of competition. You know, so I'm happy and optimistic that the Jets are headed in the right direction, I feel like, with their quarterback situation at least. But we need to get some more competition for the Patriots. I know the fans would like it to keep having cakewalks to the postseason, but it's more fun for the rest of the league when Tom Brady is battling somebody to try to win the division as opposed to just high-stepping all the way there.
I'm not sure Tom Brady is capable of high-stepping at this point. But I do think this is a really interesting division because while, I do believe the Patriots are going to win, spoiler alert, I think the Bills and Jets are really interesting teams that potentially are trending in the right direction. I, too, like the Jets quarterback, and I'm excited to talk about him and some of the offseason moves they've made there. I really like some of the things the Bills have done this offseason. And then the Dolphins, as I've said, you know, many times on this podcast, I think they're just a really fascinating team right now, right? Because they've sort of quasi-committed to something that the aforementioned football nerd Twitter, including you and me, we like, but they didn't quite commit to it, and we're going to talk about them last, and I really want to talk about them sort of from a bigger picture structural point of view with you, because I do think they're really interesting.
Oh, I don't disagree. It's going to take buy-in at the top levels to make this plan work and commitment. And so I feel like they're headed in that direction, but you're right. It's most of the moves have been with that in mind, but we want all of the moves to be made with that in mind. So they will be fun to talk about.
So before we get to the division preview, just a couple of things. First, I want to thank everyone in Seattle for coming to the live show. It was a ton of fun. KJ and Danny were really excellent, and I did do the live show before announcing that's so self-important, before telling you guys or telling people in general that I'll be doing the Rams preseason. I didn't want to get run out of Seattle, I guess, but that's something I'm doing this August, which I'm really, really excited about. They're really interesting games too, Raiders, Cowboys, Broncos in week 3, and then Houston, so I'm very pumped about that. Pumped is a word I used approximately 300 times in the video that I put out. I also want to tell you guys quickly about another podcast on our network. You probably already know about it, and that's the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast with Matthew Berry, Field Yates, and Stefania Bell. The NFL preseason is virtually upon us, which means that it's time to get ready for your fantasy football draft. I'm actually doing a Dynasty League with Danny Kelly this year, and I have no idea what I'm doing, so I need to listen to this podcast, which has all the latest positional rankings, sleepers, injury updates, and rookies you should draft, DK Metcalf, in order to win your league. Download and subscribe to the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Warren, do you do fantasy?
I do a minimal amount of fantasy. I think it's important for everybody to, you know, who's analyzing football to play it. I mean, I do one league. I was in multiple leagues in the past, but it just got too time consuming. So I still do like my home league with my friends from years ago, and they don't like it that I work sort of full time in football now because I feel like I'm constantly in the finals. But I came in second place last year, first place the year before. But I dabble in daily fantasy, but I'm certainly not as involved in that as a lot of other people.
Yeah, I used to do a bit more daily fantasy. And I, too, am, like, always in the – I'm kind of like the Steelers of fantasy football. Like, I always make it to the playoffs, but I haven't won in, I think, 8 or 9 years. I think that's – yeah, I am basically the Steelers. And I'm pretty sure Danny's going to kick my butt because he is doing fantasy full-time now for The Ringer and has a fantasy football podcast. But I do have the second overall pick in my league. So, listeners, tell me who I should take. A team
you're putting yourself in the same category as Mike Tomlin, though, because I feel like you are more with it than Mike is as a.
You're hard on him. You're hard on Pittsburgh. I've noticed that.
Well, I feel they've had the most talent of any team in the leagues and the most guys at the Pro Bowl, yeah. And they just do things that make you scratch your head when you look at it in a way that we do, right? When you analyze it to the depths that we do, if you're the casual fan, you're just like, man, they got unlucky. They lost this game. You know, they keep losing in the postseason. But if you analyze it like we do, you realize that they're making mistakes that are in the realm of coaching decisions that they could get better. And they've got a great roster. So, yeah, I'm a little bit harder on teams that should be doing more with what they've got.
You don't mean playing zone against Brady 300 times in a row isn't going to work out this year?
Putting a rookie linebacker on Keenan Allen isn't like the right idea.
Oh man, I remember. Yeah, I remember that. That was rough. Okay, well, a team that I think the expectations are a little bit lower for, but I believe, and you sort of alluded to this at the top of the show, have reason to have some excitement, reason for concern, reason for excitement, reason for skepticism. That's the New York Jets, and I want to start on a hot positive note because when we texted about this, I told you I am Sam Darnold Hive, and people who listen to the show know I'm very high on him. And Warren, part of the reason I'm high on him, well, I was high on him going into the season based on what he did in college. I do watch a fair amount of Pac-12 football, being a Huskies fan, being based out here, and I found him, I thought he had all the tools aside from, you know, some decision making and the fumbling issues. But comes out in the season, he has a good first game, I think, but then, you know, he struggled a lot, went out for a foot injury, which I think ended up being kind of helpful to him in some ways, because then he comes back and just shreds the last 4 weeks of the season. So let's start with Darnold before we get to the rest of the team. Are you as high on him as me? And more importantly, I think, are you high on the system that they're building around him?
Yeah, if you're the queen of the Sam Darnold Hive, I'll be the prince of the hive, because I'm definitely big on Darnold. Look at the context of what he had to deal with last year. You mentioned his injury. He faced a brutal schedule of defenses, and he had lackluster weaponry around him. First and foremost, he's the youngest quarterback ever to start an NFL game. Okay, that says something.
That's crazy.
You take seasoning to get good in the NFL. The second year, which we'll talk about momentarily, typically a big jump for a lot of these guys. He played the third toughest schedule of opposing defenses, the third toughest schedule of pass defenses, and what did he have to support him? The fourth most injured running back room, the 11th most injured wide receiver room. I mean, his top wide receivers, Robbie Anderson, Quincy Nunmo, in and out of the lineup all season long. The rushing offense was third worst in the league in terms of efficiency. So when you have a quarterback who's super young, playing the third toughest schedule of defenses with injured wide receivers, injured running backs, an inefficient run game, you're not getting a lot of help. And then we put on top of that the play caller and what Jeremy Bates was doing. I mean, it's no wonder. Like, the team was successful on second and long rushes, gaining 1.9 yards per carry, which was worst in the league. They were successful on just 8% of those runs when Darnold didn't run it on second and long, and yet they called 50 running back runs on second and 10 and longer. I mean, they were just setting Sam Darnold up with tough situations to overcome on third downs because of a lot of the play calling on these second and long situations. So you just stack the chips. I mean, it's going to be pretty high of all these things that Sam Darnold was having to deal with.
Yeah, and those last four games, I want to say he like led the league in QBR, but I know he was up there. They weren't against, you know, cupcake defenses either. It was the Pats, the Bills, Houston, and, Green Bay, which was not, you know, that defense wasn't good, but, he was really, really impressive. I think a few of the highlights that kind of circulated were him making these incredible athletic off-platform throws on the run, which is something he was really good at in college. Very athletic, Sam Darnold. But I was really impressed, Warren, by his play inside a clean pocket, right, which is what you want to see in a young quarterback. It's not just can he extend plays and improvise necessarily and be athletic, but can he, you know, operate inside of the pocket, read the field, read defenses, and just kind of execute on some of those higher percentage throws. And I really think he did that. Higher percentage throws, which he did not have many of last season, and because of you just described sort of his rather lackluster skill group, that's changed a bit. So, Le'Veon Bell, I have mixed feelings generally about his addition to the offense and what that means, and I want to hear your thoughts on that because. On one hand, first of all, you know, if you look at his contract, Warren, yes, we don't like I use the royal we to describe the nerd kingdom. We do not like giving running backs big contracts, but the contract's not as big as it looks. It's really like a 2-year deal. And they had the cap space. That's the other thing. If you're a team and you just got zillions of dollars to spend, I don't mind them throwing at like such a talented player who can also be there for some of those high percentage throws that didn't exist. One of my concerns, though, is, so you mentioned, you know, Jeremy Bates was not good last year. Now he's got Adam Gase and Dow Loggins, who, you know, had that good year with Cutler. But Adam Gase, one of his tendencies that I didn't like in Miami was almost an excessive dependence on checkdowns. And, you know, he did not draw up many explosive plays. And Sam Darnold has a really nice deep ball. So I guess one of my concerns is, okay, they've got Le'Veon. It's just going to be dink, dunk, Robbie Anderson. Are you worried about that as well?
There's definitely, you know, Adam Gase is not the perfect coordinator, you know, play caller in the world. He actually has a high run rate on second and long as well. So, yeah, there's certainly some things that I would hope that the Jets would be able to optimize that I don't know if Adam Gase is going to, but maybe he could improve himself. Maybe when he gets around a quarterback like Sam Darnold, you know, he'll change a little bit. Obviously, he's a little bit different when he had Peyton Manning at quarterback in Denver. So the hope is with a quarterback that he buys into and trusts that he would. But certainly, you know, there is some reason for concern. In terms of just overall Le'Veon Bell talk, You're 100% right. We don't think running backs contribute nearly as much as many people do, and so it's tough to pay them top dollar. But if there was a situation where you would be okay doing it, is when you're loading up with a rookie deal quarterback. Yeah. You know, the rookie deal quarterbacks are cheap and expensive, and so, like you said, a couple years of Le'Veon Bell is not going to be the worst thing in the world for the Jets, not going to really hamstring them too badly. So I think it is what it is. They've got the player now, and it's how are they going to most effectively use him. You have to run Le'Veon Bell, even though he's great, run him when it's optimal to run and pass to him when it's optimal to pass to him. And the rest of the time, let his presence on the football field help dictate maybe what the defense might do.
Yes.
And then you pass off of that. So I think they can still be very creative even with Le'Veon Bell there. They just have to avoid the Jay Gruden-like trap of, oh, we got a great running back now, we just want to use him a lot on first downs. Like that will torpedo Sam Darnold's efficiency if they go that conservative route.
Agreed completely. I'm just so curious, man, to see what Le'Veon Bell looks like behind a different offensive line, because this is not news to anyone who's watched him, but he's a very unusual, distinct, unique running back in terms of the way he runs, and he played for a long time behind a very, very good group with a very, very good coach. This is not a very, very good group. They did add Kelechi Osemele, who's coming off of a bad year, but it was also an injured year, and so there's hope, obviously, that will help. But, you know, it's just it's a very different situation for him. Oh, it just occurred to me, I was looking at the depth chart, Kelvin Beachum did play with him. So he's got some experience with his style. But yeah, I think this offense is trending in the right direction. Again, a lot of it's going to come down to play calling. I think the defense is too. I don't know. I guess the same, they were in the same three spot this year, and they took Quinn and Williams, who draft Twitter, I think universally saw as a slam dunk. How do you feel, I guess, this is the Jets defense that did stop the run pretty well last year. How do you feel about this front seven?
I don't mind it. You know, they've, like you said, they've got some talent. They also, fortunately for them, play the third easiest schedule of opposing offenses in the league. The one problem for them is I'm like writing this book and previewing their team and their strengths and weaknesses last year. Obviously, they were below average defense in general. And last season, you know, they went up against, you know, a below average schedule of opposing offenses too. But the one thing they were really good at is third down defense. They were the second best third down defense in the league. Every single other category, they were like 14th or worse. So third, you know, being great on third downs typically doesn't have a lot of carryover year over year. Just like, you know, the Eagles and Carson Wentz were like incredible as Super Bowl run on converting so many different third and long situations back in 2017, but couldn't really carry that over to 2018. So that is one concern about, you know, they looked better maybe in some situations than they were because of that third down defense. But I'm optimistic about the talent they have on the defensive side of the ball. And, you know, the one key for them, obviously, if they're going to make some noise this season, which, I mean, the hope is by the time Sam Darnold is about to get paid that you've already won a Super Bowl, right? So it may or may not come his second season, but the hope is that it could. It's very difficult for a second team to get out of the AFC East. So you have to figure out how you're going to beat the Patriots and produce a better in-season record than them to earn a playoff spot. I mean, it's just difficult to get that wild card spot. There are a lot of decent teams in the AFC competing for it. That's going to be the challenge if they're going to reach their ultimate goal. But right now, I mean, we got to get them above 500 first. We can't put the cart in front of the horse. That, you know, they're a 5-11, 5-11, 4-12 team the last 3 years. So we got to get winning record before we can talk playoffs, I think.
Yeah, I think there the potential is there on the. We talked about the offense. As far as the defense goes, like this is a very. And sort of whether or not they're a playoff caliber group, I guess. There's a lot of concerns in the secondary outside of Jamal Adams. His cornerbacks are not great. And I like the front seven. I mean, it's a 3-4. You've got Williams, Quinn, and Henry Anderson up front, which is really nice, but there's not really an outside pass rush, right? Now they've got Greg, who we know is very aggressive, and you imagine he'll be sending Jamal Adams a lot and trying to work around that. With some creativity in terms of blitzing, but there's not a ton of talent there at edge rusher. So that would be, I think, my biggest concern about that side of the ball other than cornerback. But, you know, just up the middle, you've got Quinnen, CJ Mosley, whatever you feel about his contract, he's a good player, and then Jamal Adams. So, like, the spine of that defense is set. So it kind of, like, I look at this team and I think, wow, they've got the building blocks in play. They just don't have like those solid players on the margins that you see on a high caliber playoff team. And that's kind of where I come down on them. I do think they're my number two team right now, though, in the division.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, and as we know, passing is more important than rushing, and passing offense is more important than, you know, passing defense. That being said, where they struggle defensively is from a talent perspective, I guess, are the positions that you would need to have to be good defending the pass, right? They don't have great edge rushers, and then their cornerbacks are a question. They've got good safeties. They're really good up the middle. Like you mentioned, Leonard Williams, one of the NFL's best run-blocking interior defenders, and then Quinnen Williams was one of the best pass rushing interior defenders. But you got those guys in the middle. I think they're going to be set and on the second level and at safety, but I worry about the edges, as you kind of indicated, with the corners and the edge rushers. So that will be interesting.
Well, let's talk about the Bills, and let's work from the other side of the ball, because this secondary is ridiculous. Like, they're really good. So when I do this kind of exercise, where I go through the depth charts and sort of get caught up on, you know, just who's on the teams, very, you know, it can take a little second to catch up, I guess. And I almost feel like the Bills, just we're going to work backwards from that pass defense, which, you know, has put up numbers now for a couple of years, but it kind of feels like they're underrated at this point. Like, you don't, I really don't think enough people talk about what Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer have done, in this defense, and how excellent Sean McDermott, who was a safety in college, by the way, and so that might explain some of it, how skilled he has been at finding, drafting, developing, defensive players on that side of the ball. And it's not just them, and it's not just Tre'Davious White, who we know was very good, and got a little bit targeted more last year as a number one cornerback, but Levi Wallace, Taron Johnson, like really underrated, kind of like what I was mentioning with the Jets don't have those sort of super solid plus defensive players and defensive backs. The Bills have a really nice secondary.
They do. And, you know, just to start for me on the defense, you have to look at Sean McDermott, who you alluded to. And I think having playmakers, having difference makers on your roster, you can't get around it. Like, if you've got those guys, you know, it's a great thing to have. I think coaching is really underrated. I think coaching is so underrated in the NFL. And you're absolutely right. The defense of the Bills doesn't get talked about as much as it should, and the coach of the Bills, in my opinion, doesn't get talked about as much as it should. I mean, look at what he did, taking that team to a 9-7 record in 2017 in a playoff game. I mean, they had no business at all. They had the NFL's worst, least efficient offense that year, and they're making the playoffs. You know, last year, what do we expect? We're going to talk about the offense a little bit, but I went super hard on the Bills under 7 wins last year, and, you know, as hard as you possibly could go. And it ended up winning, right? But they did well over that second half of the season and turned some things around. And I actually am a little bit more optimistic on this team headed into this year than I certainly was heading into last year, to the point where, like, I would not have any desire to go under their 7-win total this season. Not to say that they may not win 6 games, but the fact is I don't see a lot of value in doing that. And one of the big reasons is because of the defense. And because of the great defense that they have, it's very infrequent that they're going to be in games where they're just getting absolutely blown out, as long as the offense doesn't make mistakes, right? And as long as Josh Allen doesn't make mistakes, they're probably going to be in a lot of games. If you look at, like, what they did over the last 7 weeks of the season last year, they lost one game to the New England Patriots by more than 4 points. I mean, that was it. Like, they either won their other games or lost by close margins. So I'm optimistic about this team, but you're absolutely right. It starts first and foremost with the talent coupled with the great coaching that they've assembled there.
Well, let's talk about Josh Allen. So we started from the back, and I have, you know, I was not high on him as draft pick. I think he was better than I expected, just because my expectations were very low. Now, you talked about him, the potential for him kind of making mistakes and losing games, and him needing to limit that. I'll talk about what he did well, but one of the things that concerns me about him in terms of potentials for regression for this team, Warren, is he should have thrown more interceptions than he did, because a lot of the picks he did throw were on him. I would put, well, I mean, you know, he had terrible wide receivers, and we can talk about that a little bit and some of the changes they made there and on the offensive line. But, he did struggle at times to read coverages. And then he also, fumbled the ball quite a bit. He fumbled 8 times and only lost 2, which, as we know, is something that regresses and something that concerns me given how much he runs with the football.
It's hard for a guy that big to avoid the, you know, he's got a big bullseye, let's put it that way. So yeah. It's easy for guys to target a guy that size. Now, fortunately, he's fast, but, you know, that's at some point that catches up with you. One of the big reasons, though, that I liked the under on this team last year is because I projected them to face this brutal schedule of defenses, especially to start the year, and I figured Josh Allen was going to be their quarterback to start the year. I mean, they faced the NFL's most difficult schedule through the first 9 weeks of the season. They faced the third toughest schedule of run defenses. And, again, when you are a young quarterback and your coaches inevitably, I mean, it's unfortunate, but just the way the world works, going to probably call a little bit more run plays than he should. And when you are a young quarterback and you're getting more run plays called, but you're playing a brutal schedule of run defenses, or your run offense is just terrible, it doesn't have the right level of talent, you're not going to be able to do a lot. You're not going to get any support. You're going to have to put so much on your shoulders, and that's exactly what Josh Allen had to do last year, and that's one of the reasons why his rushing became so valuable later in the season, is because the ground game itself wasn't producing very much, and the talent at wide receiver wasn't giving him nearly as much help. I think back to when we were at Sloan and when Mike Leach talked about the most important characteristics of quarterbacks, and you know, John Elway, you ask him and he'll talk about arm strength, but that doesn't matter to Mike Leach. Mike Leach's number one most important quality for a quarterback is accuracy. You need to be able to stand there, and you either got the talent or you don't, to be 20 yards away and throw a snowball and hit the stop sign. You're either a kid who's good at doing that or you're not. And you know, Josh Allen, his biggest problem in college and last year was accuracy. So on top of the turnover issues that you highlighted, where he was on the positive side of that and that might regress, it's hard to improve your accuracy, and he certainly struggles doing that. So they tried to add players around him this past off season who could alleviate some of that. You know, like John Brown might be able to get open easier. Cole Beasley is going to be that short receiver up close to him to provide like a good security blanket. Hopefully he's got a better situation at tight end, although, I mean, that remains to be determined. I think they worked in the right direction to try to give him the tools that he needs, but it's going to come down to how accurate can he be, and how much does he cause these egregious game-turning mistakes like fumbles or interceptions.
Yeah, I think, and by the way, in addition to the sort of adds that they made, they also improved the offensive line, drafting Cody Ford, signing Mitch Morse, making him the highest paid center, I believe, in football, although he just looks like he's going to be out for a bit with a concussion, so you never know how long that lasts, which has to be disappointing for Buffalo. And that should help a lot as well. But the accuracy question is like really interesting to me, because I can't remember when I said this last season, Warren, but to me, Allen's ceiling, his upside is, he reminded me of Cam Newton at times, quite frankly. I don't know if, I hope that's not a lazy comparison, but it had a little bit to do with some of his skills, because obviously the running and the athleticism and the size is part of that. But also, you know, he can make big time throws, man. Like there were a few throws near the end of the season. I remember especially to, I think it was Robert Foster, where he threw with touch, like just beautiful passes. But then he does miss some of the easier intermediate throws, just some of his outs where he would just throw it into the dirt. And I guess what I want to ask you about him in terms of the way to approach his skill set, knowing, and I don't know if you agree with the Cam Newton thing, but kind of thinking about how Cam has been managed, would you design an offense around Josh where you're baking in a lot of designed runs, and you know, you're almost treating him the way Cam was treated at times, because that's, I guess, what he's been so good at?
Well, first of all, that's a great question, but that's an even better comparison to Cam Newton. Because if you look at like some of the accuracy issues that Cam struggled with, one of the things that Carolina had was some bigger wide receivers. And of course, Kelvin Benjamin was there with Cam. And Kelvin is a 6'5" guy who has a 99th percentile catch radius. And what Buffalo had been doing, like especially in 2018, was surrounding Allen with these big guys, you know, with high catch radiuses. Zay Jones, their second round pick, he's 6'2", but he had a 93rd percentile catch radius. And so they were sticking guys with like long arms and size there to try to catch some of these less accurate passes. They went in a totally different direction this past off season and scrapped the size and catch radius in favor of speed and quickness. So they're getting like smaller and faster guys, and maybe McDermott saw what Steve Smith brought to the table a little bit with Cam Newton early in his career. Newton won the MVP when Kelvin tore his ACL that year, but Ted Ginn, a 5'10" guy, caught 10 touchdowns. So smaller guys, quicker guys, and look at what Carolina has there now. I mean, apart from Greg Olsen, they've got a lot of these smaller, quicker guys, and Cam had his best, you know, one of his best seasons. He actually had a tremendous season in terms of his accuracy and whatnot before he got hurt. So what Buffalo did, they go after, you know, John Brown. He's got an arm length in the 17th percentile, but he runs a 3-4. Cole Beasley, again, another guy, tiny, short arms, but an 82 percentile burst score. Robert Foster, he's below 50% in catch radius, but is a 91st percentile 40-yard dash guy. So they're putting these smaller, quicker guys around Josh Allen and hoping that that's the right way to deal with his accuracy issues as opposed to slower, longer-armed guys. In terms of designed runs, I definitely agree with you. At some point, you have to look at your quarterback and get accustomed to what his strengths and weaknesses are and then decide, we don't want to kill this guy, but at the same time, how are we going to do something in his rookie deal, right? Like, we want to pay him again in a few years? That's to be determined. How can we reach our ceiling while we still got him under this cheap rookie deal contract? And the answer is you've got to try to figure out ways to intelligently utilize his running ability. Now, there's two times that you can intelligently utilize a quarterback's running ability. The first way is on some of those designed runs that hopefully are not too frequent but are at the right time to have high success rates, get you those key leverage first downs that you need. And then the second time is when you're looking to pass the ball and read one is taken away, read two, you move off of, and you see a lane, and you take that as opposed to trying to force the ball into another guy. And hopefully you're taking that run because there's a lane there that's open and you can get down and avoid contact. So I definitely think that, you know, utilizing him in intelligent manners by either designed runs or coaching him up on when to take those open run lanes is going to be a big part of the picture as to whether Buffalo can win games this year or not.
I also think, you know, we talk about second-year quarterbacks and defenses adjusting and they've got the tape, yada, yada. I think defenses are going to punish him a lot more for running than they did last season. For whatever reason, it felt like a lot of the defenses that they faced were not as prepared for the rushing threat of Josh Allen as they were for, say, Lamar Jackson. And I think you can kind of speculate as to why that is. Look, I would be remiss if I didn't give my nod to my beloved Ed Oliver, who Dan Fedes is reporting, just pushed the offensive line into Josh Allen, causing him to fall to the ground. Sean McDermott got pissed and yelled at him to get off the field. It was actually an offensive lineman. He had to correct himself, but I really liked the visual of Ed Oliver pushing the entire offensive line. All right, before we get to the mailbag, I want to take a quick second and tell you guys about ButcherBox. Summer's here, and you know what that means. It's barbecue season. And if you're like me, you'll be serving your friends and family the incredible meat from ButcherBox. From grass-fed beef to free-range organic chicken to wild-caught sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay, Alaska, ButcherBox has over 20 different cuts of meat to choose from with customizable boxes and a variety of options to choose from. They work closely with the best farms and companies committed to raising animals humanely. This ensures not only an ethical process, but one that results in a better quality, better tasting, nutrition-dense meat with no added hormones or antibiotics ever. ButcherBox is delivered right to your door with free shipping. And a month's worth of the meat from ButcherBox comes out to less than $6 a meal. Whether you're cooking for all of your friends and family or just yourself, ButcherBox has the cuts and options you need to make every meal a memorable one. And ButcherBox is making sure you have burgers for all of your barbecues this summer season. They are offering new members who sign up at ButcherBox.com/Mina $20 off their first box. Plus, 6 free burgers in every box until October 15th. That's a lot of burgers. That's ButcherBox.com/Mina for $20 off your first box, plus free burgers in every box until October 15th. ButcherBox.com/Mina.
Question. Question. Lenny, for your thoughts.
All right, Warren, I want you to help me answer some of these. As always, if you leave a question in my iTunes reviews with a 5-star review, I will answer it. And we're catching up on these questions. First one is from Dapper Dan Mann. How do you see Antonio Brown doing this year versus last, and will Hard Knocks help public perception? Well, I can't see public perception getting any worse, so I'll start there. As far as him on the field, Warren, you know, I talked about this a lot with the Raiders when we talked about the division, and I'm very curious because I guess I really hope Antonio Brown brings out the best of Carr and that he doesn't only get used for, you know, 5 yard slants and whatnot, because that would be very limiting.
It would. I think the upside, I think Ben Roethlisberger as a quarterback is underrated when you look at like the best quarterbacks in the league. And I think Derek Carr is just rated, you know. I think people's opinion of Derek Carr is probably pretty close to being accurate, that they're not super high on him. He's also, you know, not the worst option out there. But I definitely think it's a slight downgrade from what, you know, Ben Roethlisberger was providing him. And it's going to take timing and chemistry. I think from a volume perspective, he could be in for a good opportunity. That's one thing that John Gruden does is I think John Gruden has his faults with managing personnel. But as an X's and O's coach on the field, he's pretty good. And I think he's going to be able to design some things that get Antonio Brown the opportunities that he needs. The issue is, you know, can Derek Carr deliver when he's in those opportunities? And then what's the mindset back in the huddle and afterwards if Antonio doesn't feel like he's showing out like he wants to?
Matt from Patreon asks, in the NFC, who are the dark horses to get the Super Bowl? Ooh. Well, okay, so I have said I'm very high on the Eagles, but they're not a dark horse. And I also am, I think, higher than a lot of people on the Packers, but I wouldn't classify them as a dark horse. So a dark horse NFC team that I am high on is Carolina. I think that front seven is ridiculous. I think if Cam plays like he did before he got hurt last season, that offense could be very good. So I'm going to go with Carolina. What about you, Warren?
I actually like your answer very much. I think the Dallas Cowboys are going to be a very good team also to give the Eagles some competition. You know, we'll see what happens with the Zeke holdout and whatnot. But, you know, from the NFC South, there's obviously, you know, Bruce Arians coming into Tampa adds intrigue there, but their defense is just so bad. I think those three teams that are battling in between the Saints, who are obviously one of the favorites, right? So that's not a dark horse at all. The Falcons and the Panthers, I mean, the Panthers right now have a lower win total. They are projected to be worse than the Falcons, but I think that there is a lot of upside in them. So if I had to pick a team that was projected to finish like third or worse in their own division to make the playoffs in the NFC, I would probably have to agree with you. Although I will tell you, I also am higher on San Francisco than some other people are.
You are.
So projected to finish third, yes.
Interesting. Yeah, we didn't get, I mean, we talked about them in the preview last week for the NFC West. I think I described them as the highest variance team in football right now to me. I think that pass rush could be absurd, but the secondary is real, real bad. Although, you know, if Eric is healthy, that's, I guess it's a little bit better. And then, you know, Jimmy G, who knows? So, there's a variance there. Garf Parm asks, I'll take this one. Are the Seahawks as dumb as Seahawks Twitter seems to think they are? Oh boy, that's a complicated question. Listen, we don't need to go over the whole run pass balance thing here. Warren and I have talked about that a lot. I'll say this. I don't think that Seahawks Twitter, and I certainly don't speak for it as a whole, the loudest voices think that everything Seattle does is bad. I think they just use it as a vehicle to complain about the things they don't like. Because, you know, I was just, I can't remember, I was talking to Charles or someone online about how the Seattle was very smart to trade for Dwayne Brown and extend him, for example. That deal looks great now. Or the Tyler Lockett deal. Wow, that looks amazing. And I think I mentioned last week, as much as people are frustrated with the offense, and at times rightfully so for some of the situational decisions, they do use a ton of play action, and they were pretty efficient. So you could say that was despite some of the choices, but you know, it's certainly not. I don't think you can say a team that's successful is failing. I'll just say that.
Can I hijack for 1 second, Mina?
Yeah, you can get in here.
I just want to throw in there that Seahawks Twitter, from an outside perspective, I'm not part of that group, but one of the most intelligent fan bases out there, at least from a Twitter perspective that I interact with, it seems to know their stuff. And look, the point of being a fan, in my opinion, I'm not a fan of any team, right? I like efficiency. I'm an analyst, so I don't really have like a team that I cling to and support. But if I did, and that team was making dumb decisions or investing in dumb areas or calling things that were bad, I think the way I would want to deal with that is to be critical, because I want my team to win the Super Bowl. And I can't tell you the number of fan bases that I interact with. Some are more obvious than others, that will defend any coach's decision, any front office's decision, as like gospel. And even though they want their team to win, they like zero criticism about their team. And so they'll get on you even when you're stating facts that are simply facts, like no opinion. You're just stating facts that might reflect negatively about choices they made, but you're not including any opinion to that. They get all bent out of shape. And I think that that's one of the most counterproductive things that fan bases can do. I think all coaches, all GMs, myself, anybody in life makes mistakes, has problems, things that they can improve upon, and pretending they don't exist and not discussing them is not helpful. I think bringing them to light, talking about them, is the only way some of those things are going to get resolved. And so I, for one, like the fact that Seahawks Twitter is aggressive and has high expectations about their football team.
I think, you know, part of the reason fans do that, I've thought about this a lot, is the same reason that they side with ownership and contracts stuff. Well, you know, a lot of that's because of the hard cap. But I think there's this kind of feeling amongst fan bases, well, the coach and the GM aren't going anywhere, so they want to believe that they're making all the right decisions, right, versus the player. I've always felt like if you really love something, you should want it to be better. But Coolin Hair asks, what is the Eagles' biggest weakness? So people who have listened to our previews know I'm very high on Philadelphia, and I actually find it really hard to find overt weaknesses with this roster. I'll just kind of quickly, I would say, you know, backup quarterbacks concerning. Wentz's health is obviously the number one potentially limiting factor. That's not a really original thought when it comes to football. But it's uniquely concerning with him. And then I'll say the secondary has a lot to prove to me. I think they're in obviously better position from a health standpoint that they've been. But, you know, we gotta see it on the field.
You hit it dead on, and from my perspective, it's a secondary, because they have some guys who are missing some time in camp right now, and that was one of their biggest weaknesses that they had last year. I mean, it allowed Carolina rally in a game where they were down 17-0, and Carolina came back and won that game late. It was a problem for them, was their secondary. So I think that I love the front seven. Offensively, it starts and ends with that offensive line, which is great. I think locking up Wentz for a longer term is great, too. You got to be a little bit concerned with his health. So you're right, backup quarterback would probably be my next concern after secondary, but overall a really deep roster.
Last question from mcarlos78. It's a three-part question that I will get through very quickly. One, I play fantasy football and haven't heard much about Jason Witten. There's a reason for that. Number two, will you be doing a zipline breakdown on how the Colts will win the Super Bowl? I will not. By the way, Andrew Luck, this health stuff, very concerning. There's not really much to talk about there, but they're holding him out with concerns right now about the calf, and it's not what you want to hear if you're a Colts fan. Question three, why does Lenny have such a feminine voice? How dare you? No, I'm not even answering that. How dare you? All right. I am excited to talk about the Patriots with you, in particular, Warren, because it gives us an excuse to, I think, we're not going to talk about the run thing, it's the running back importance, but one of the things that's interesting to me about New England, and I think this is relevant to their prospects for a season in which there's a ton of uncertainty at pass catcher, right? It's very thin for them, is how they've kind of become a cudgel for defenders of the run in this offseason. So people have pointed, those who would like to argue that, hey, runnings backs matter more than you analytics geeks think, and there's a lot of pointing to the Patriots and what they did in the postseason. The fact that they leaned so, they did run the ball a great deal, so it's unequivocal that they ran the ball a lot, and it's unequivocal that they won the Super Bowl. I think what's less set in stone is that running the football is why. So I want to start there with you and talk a little bit about the Patriots' approach in the postseason, because I do think it matters for this coming season.
Well, you know, one of the things that a lot of teams do that are really successful offensively is they find something like an idiosyncrasy, something they could do that's a little bit different that they can kind of like claim as a little bit more of their own, and force opposing defenses to, oh my God, okay, now we're playing this team and they do a ton of this stuff. So we got to like switch up how we normally play offenses because this team does a lot of this. And for the Patriots, that's a lot of high usage of their fullback, you know, 21 personnel, way above the league average. And they're really effective with it. Now, do they run most of the time when they've got 21? Yes. But the threat of the pass is very vital to their ability to disguise things. And the Patriots are a team, people need to realize that the Patriots are a team that will just as easily, if they're playing a really good run defense, run the ball two times in the first series and then just abandon it and have Tom Brady throw the ball 45 or 50 times the rest of the game. Like, they will call plays and adapt to what other teams are doing on the drop of a hat better than any single other team in the league. So if they're having some success being a little bit balanced and their runs are having some success, they're going to continue calling efficient plays. And for them, if it happens to be a run play and they're defeating you with it, they're going to continue to utilize that. That is not to say that this is a team that is so run dominant that they just have an identity and that's what they're going to do regardless of who they play, kind of like Seattle last year going into Dallas, who had one of the best run defenses in the league and just ran the ball nonstop for the first three quarters.
Not to upset
Seahawks Twitter and you. But like if you look at the Patriots, after a first and 10 incompletion, you know, the league tends to go very run heavy. They run the ball 47% of the time on second and 10. That's ridiculous. I mean, teams should be passing the ball a lot more than 53% of the time. But the Patriots go 69% past the fourth highest rate in the league. So they're calling runs in more opportune situations to run, but they're being intelligent for when they decide to choose to throw the football. And overall, I think they just have a very intelligent approach to understanding their strengths and their opponent's weaknesses, and they're willing to flip things on a dime and simply manage efficient game plans, and that's one of the best things about this team. And I think as we see what they're going to do in 2019, it's probably going to be a lot of similarities. I mean, people look at one thing I'll add, people especially now, though, I guess the way people view football is very driven by fantasy because fantasy has inundated us and, you know, it's all around us, that people look at, you know, the touchdowns and how Tom Brady didn't have quite as many passing touchdowns maybe as he's had in the past and the running back touchdowns. But that was intelligent on their part. In 2017, they were way too pass-heavy when they were near the goal line, and they completely switched that up last season. They went much, much more run-heavy, had a lot of success, and so they had a lot of rushing touchdowns. But that's the time you want to run the football, is near the goal line. That's when you do want to run the football.
Yeah, the extreme layman's version of everything Warren just said is the Patriots play the team in front of them, which far too few teams in the NFL do. He's right about all of that. The notion also, I think, Warren, that the Patriots kind of ran their way to the Super Bowl is false, right? I mean, we're talking about a Super Bowl in which they won when they threw the ball at the end. Now, you could contend that they're able to succeed sometimes in passing situations, not because of running the football to get there, but from a more meta, in terms of like dictating coverages and dictating how defenses respond to them, right? And that Kansas City game, by the way, they ran a ton, but I don't think any of the quarterbacks, or the running backs rather, averaged over 4 yards per carry. I asked Ben Baldwin to pull a couple of days ago, I was just curious, EPA numbers for run and pass plays in that game, and they were significantly more efficient passing, especially, I think on third down, they were like three times as efficient. Now, again, there is a strategic element to all of this, or to the way, why they do the things they do, in terms of affecting coverages, but it is very interesting to be like, they did not win by running and running alone. But yeah, they don't have pass catchers. They don't have tight ends, right? And this is a team that, as you know, is historically used a ton of 12. And let's see, who is there? I am extremely remiss. They added, it's like the BC kid or someone is replacing. I mean, you know, Gronk's going to come back. Matt LaCrosse, pardon me, from Illinois is like their starting tight end. So tons of question marks there. I would say the other question mark, just to kind of wrap up the team, because otherwise there's not that much else to talk about with the division, is pass rusher, right? Losing Trey Flowers. The Patriots defense was really interesting, Warren, because they look completely different in the playoffs and were able to just dial up a pass rush out of nothing that suddenly became the best pass rush in the NFL. Do you think that's, I mean, I guess they've got some guys coming back, and but is that an area of concern for them in your mind?
Slightly. I do want to touch on one of the things you said about the postseason just specifically. You're absolutely right. They played who is in front of them. If you look, they played three teams in the playoffs, the Chiefs and the Chargers and the Rams, who all ranked top 12 against the pass. But literally the two last teams they played, the Chiefs and the Rams, were bottom five in terms of run defense in the league. So, of course, they're realizing that we can run the ball a little bit more on these guys, so they're calling a higher rate. But you're right, you know, the passes were certainly the more efficient plays that they were able to generate. I do have slight concerns about their pass rush, but I think this is probably, I mean, when you couple the coaching from Bill Belichick and the game planning for specific opponents into, like, what their secondary and the strengths of that is going to be, I think this is probably one of the more underrated defenses in the league.
Really?
And, you know, the identity of this team might switch a little bit. If that offense, you know, without the usage of Gronk, and Gronk last year was staying in more to run block, right? He couldn't get out as many pass routes with his back issue. So they were using a lot more of his blocking ability in those 21 personnel sets to run the football from. He's not going to be doing that as much anymore. So the team might end up passing a little bit more, but not having a guy like Gronk to command those coverages and dictate to the defense what they have to do from a personnel perspective is going to free up things, and their offense might take a step back with, you know, the lack of receiving options and weaponry that they have. So I definitely think that the defense is going to play a bigger role. And if you look at the schedule that they're going to face, I've got them playing the second easiest schedule of opposing offenses in the league. So I think this defense is really going to be valuable. I mean, not just from like a fantasy perspective, but from an overall perspective in terms of being more a reason why the team has success in 2019.
Interesting. Yeah, and some of those often, like, I remain convinced that Gronk's coming back. They could get Josh Gordon back at some point, you know, who knows. Nikhil Harry could turn into a beast by the end of the season. But on defense, you know, other than the pass rush, they are super, super solid. Like the Bills, extremely, well, I don't know if they're underrated in secondary. People know who Gilmore is, but a very, very good secondary. Linebacker group, superstar. I believe that Hightower is, like, probably, if you look at what he's done in the postseason, it should be regarded as one of the most Patriots, or most important Patriots in team history. But I'm not worried about that either. Yeah, it's just a pass rush, and, but given their success in, I mean, this is a team that has always thrived without elite pass rushers, so I have no doubt that they'll continue to find a way. All right, we wrap with a team that is finding a way to do something very different. The question I have about the Dolphins and my beloved fish tank is whether they're actually committed to doing that different thing, which is rebuilding and actually rebuilding, right? I know I joke about the tank, but it's not really about tanking. It's about, I guess, committing to a process, you know? And that's my concern, I guess, about this team going into this season, this off season. I was super stoked when they started letting guys walk. You know, they released Amendola, Robert Quinn. They let Cameron Wake walk. They traded Ryan Tannehill. They have to eat a lot of dead money this year, but without looking at it, I'm sure that they lead the league in 2020 cap space at this point, even after paying Xavien Howard, who deserved it. How do you feel about Fish Tank in general? Like, how do you feel about how it's going?
Well, they're attacking it from a number of different avenues, right? Letting the guys walk is what then leads to comp picks. And in 5 years from 2015 to 2019, they received only three comp picks. And that's because they were investing in free agency a lot. This year, I believe with what they did this year, they're scheduled in 2020 to receive an extra third and an extra fifth thanks to the compensatory distribution. So that's beneficial. They were also trading away guys, you know, and getting more picks that way. So both of those things are a positive. I think in general, the fish tank strategy is going well, better than it could be going. But, you know, I do wonder, obviously we know what the most important position is towards determining wins and losses, and that's the quarterback. And they have a bit of a quarterback controversy or battle, at least, down there between Josh Rosen and Ryan Fitzpatrick. I guess the question that you would have to answer if you want to determine is Fish Tank going as optimal as possible is what direction did they ultimately decide to go from a quarterback perspective? One guy is much more seasoned, has probably a higher floor, and will give you a chance. The other guy, you don't really know what you're going to get out of him, and that's Josh Rosen. He could be a disaster because the offensive line is going to be horrible, and that's what he had to deal with in Arizona, and he didn't put up great numbers. So, I don't know. What is your take, I guess, on the quarterback position itself?
Yeah. It's kind of like, what is my take on it vis-a-vis the strategy as well, and that's what complicates it, right? Like, in a vacuum, you know, yes, Fitzpatrick he's winning. I think Flores came out and said he's outplaying, which isn't terribly surprising. We know who Ryan Fitzpatrick is as a quarterback, right? We know he's gonna win some games and light up some defenses, and then he's gonna Fitzpatrick himself, you know? And I guess that doesn't help things. You could argue, well, it's good to, you know, if you're against tanking on principle, if you're against being really, really bad because you want to sit back and evaluate some of the young players you have and you feel that you can best do that with a capable quarterback, that's one approach. But I don't even think the Dolphins have players they got to evaluate, okay? Especially on offense. They have a couple building blocks, I guess, on the defense. But I don't know. I don't really see the benefit to having Ryan Fitzpatrick win 7 games. I don't. I know, again, you don't, like, the Browns' intention, it was never to lose that many games. So you're not trying to be the worst team in the NFL. You're trying to, as you said, amass picks and assets and clear cap space. That's the goal. It's not really about just being awful. But I just don't see the utility of going with Fitzpatrick for the entire season. It just doesn't make a ton of sense to me strategically.
Yeah, and I think, like, on the positive front for the Dolphins, Chris Greer, he's got enough draft capital this upcoming year where if he needed to do something, like if they end up winning too many games or something like that, now we're not thinking they're going to win, you know, 9 games and make the postseason, but if they ended up winning too many games and they couldn't, you know, be the shoe-in for that number one pick, he's got enough draft capital to make moves happen to get what he wants. But it's always better, to naturally just fall to that position. And I agree, the floor is a little bit higher with Ryan Fitzpatrick. And from a good perspective, they face the third most difficult schedule of opposing pass defenses, the second most difficult schedule of overall defenses. So their offense is going to be in trouble regardless of who is lining up behind center. And that offensive line is, from a talent perspective, one of the worst in the NFL. I could see from a, you know, rebuild and a new coach is here, the vision that, hey, we're going to start Ryan Fitzpatrick because he thinks he gives us the best opportunity to win games. And we know we've got a long road ahead of us, so, you know, he's not going to come out publicly, say we're going to try to lose games. So it paints a good picture for the fans, I guess. And then if Fitzpatrick ends up being bad, you can put Josh Rosen in, and you'd have the argument, well, we didn't think he was ready to start, so we wanted Fitzpatrick. But that way, even if Rosen is bad, you know, you don't look as terrible by having gone out and acquiring him from the Arizona Cardinals. But if you end up starting Josh Rosen from day one and he doesn't look good, then it's like, wow, these guys really made a mistake going out and acquiring Josh Rosen. So I could see that as a reason, like, why Brian Flores might be more inclined to start Fitzpatrick. But from everything I know, Brian Flores' job is secure. He does not have to worry that the team's not going to win year one or even year two. Like, he's got a 5-year deal. This is a long-term rebuild. Everybody, hopefully, is on board in the building from the owner on down that this is going to take time and there's a right way to do it. And, you know, hopefully they executed in that right way, and hopefully Brian Flores is making decisions, like you said, to either evaluate players or do different things that are going to be in their best interest long term, as opposed to what will make the fans like me week one, what will make, you know, the ownership not want to get rid of me after the first 8 weeks of the season. You know, hopefully he's making those decisions from that perspective.
And just to correct myself, the Dolphins actually, after the Howard deal, currently they're sixth in 2020 cap space. They have a ton of picks next year. I think outside of the first, they have an extra pick in every round after all the trades that they've made. I mean, I personally think they could keep doing it. Like, I was thinking, Warren, when the Giants lost another receiver, I was looking at, you know, because receiver is actually a decent area on this depth chart for the Dolphins. They've got Kenny Stills, Devontae Parker, Albert Wilson. They're all pretty good. I was thinking, like, they added Allen Hurns too. Maybe they could trade one of those guys to the Giants and get even more picks. Let's wrap up the Dolphins here. Like, who can you build around on this team? So, I mentioned Xavien Howard. I think he's kind of the no-brainer breakout star on that defense. Probably the end of the road for Rashad Jones. You know, Minkah Fitzpatrick is an interesting one. I think they would want him to be a building block. I'm really excited to see what Brian Flores does with him, because I think they did not use him properly. He's sort of one of those Swiss Army DBs that every defense wants now, and I don't think he was used exactly right last season, so I'm excited to see Brian Flores paired with him. I guess Laremy Tunsil. Is there any other, and Christian Wilkins, right? Are there any other players that you kind of look on this roster and you think, yes, he can be part of the future Dolphins?
Yeah, I think you hit them. You know, up front on both lines is Christian Wilkins and Laremy Tunsil. Like, can those guys both anchor those lines and be in the future, you know, for this team? Obviously, Xavien Howard is a stud, and they extended him, and of course, Minkah Fitzpatrick. So, they've got some pieces that they can start working with and are in the long term. I think what Brian Flores needs to do is to get those guys to grow in leadership roles and establish good. It's hard. This is going to be one of the biggest challenges for him, is on a team that may be losing a lot of games, to keep the hard work mentality that is going to, you know, bleed through from 2019 to 2020 and 2021. It's about getting these guys to buy into working hard every single day and getting better and improving, so that you don't lose hope and so that you manage these guys the right way. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, is almost like a psychological challenge that Brian Flores is going to face as a coach trying to do a complete rebuild with not a whole lot of, you know, solid veterans on the roster that are going to be part of the future. It's going to be a challenge.
I would love to, I think, coupled with discussions of rebuilding and how you do that and the sort of analytical perspective, I think you just tapped into something so important, which is the psychological approach to that. Like, I would love for Brett Brown on the Sixers to, like, give a class on that, right? Because he comes to mind as someone who's navigated a team through both stages. And it's very, very rare, I think, in any league, in any sport, to see teams that have successfully pulled that off. It's not easy. So
no, it's a big part of coaching. You know, this is why coaching is so important, is being able to get the pulse of the team, being able to motivate them psychologically, deal with them emotionally after, you know, tough losses. And, you know, there's just a lot that goes into it. But if you can focus on that and excel in those certain areas of the psychological elements of it, that's going to be an edge, because I don't think a lot of coaches – have, you know, great grasp on some of those aspects of it. It's harder than it looks. Coaching is tough. Coaching grown men who play a physical sport like the NFL is exceedingly difficult. So more power to him. But if Brian Flores can manage that, I think he's got a, it's going to lay a great foundation for the future here.
Coaching is definitely challenging. So is hiring. But there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate to the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MINA. ZipRecruiter.com/Mina. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
All right, Warren, I have 5 questions for you. I have 4. The 5th is, it's from Lenny. You ready?
I was born ready. Let's do this.
Okay. Just a quick reminder, guys, I'm joined by Warren Sharp, Sharp Football. Check out his 2019 guide for the NFL season. It's a really, lot of really good info and a lot of like different info, which is always hard to find in today's analytical landscape. My first question for you. So, a reader or a listener, I always say reader. A listener asked for my NFC dark horse. I gave the Panthers. Who's your AFC dark horse?
In the AFC, good question. I would probably go with the Baltimore Ravens. And
really?
A lot of people are down on the Ravens because of Lamar Jackson. They don't think he's a good quarterback. They don't think he's going to take the next step. They think that defenses might have adjusted, that the Chargers' game plan is just what everybody's going to use to beat this team. But I think they've got higher upside than people think. I think that they're going to let Lamar Jackson throw the ball a little bit more this season than people think. I think that the context of Lamar's season last year, where he didn't get starters reps in camp, he held a clipboard most of the games for the first 10 weeks, and then when he was inserted, it was a totally different offense than he had been watching on the field for those first 10 weeks, and all the players had to run a totally different system that was unique for all of them to adapt to as well. I think there was just a lot of moving parts last season. I think they're going to be in a better situation this year. I'm looking forward to Earl Thomas's impact on that defense. I know they lost some key leaders there, but I think that this is going to be a team that's worthy of being a dark horse. They have the pedigree, and they play this unique style that opposing teams are going to have to adjust for that singular week that they play them. And I think sometimes that's a very efficient asset to have on your side. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do this year.
I was thinking about that when you mentioned the wide receiver approach the Bills are taking and kind of in whose Cam has succeeded with, because you know, the Ravens went out and added Hollywood, who we're now hearing is practicing, who fits that paradigm of just being, you know, tiny and fast. But then they also added Boykin, who's enormous, and then they've got Mark Andrews, who's like kind of one of my favorite fantasy grabs and has a really nice chemistry with Lamar. So I'll be curious to see kind of which of those pieces is able to make an impact given his skill set. Question 2. What is your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'd probably just go with Pulp Fiction, although I like Django Unchained, too. You know, is there a bad one? I don't know.
Are you a Tarantino fan? I should have asked you that first.
I'm a fan, but the thing is I don't watch a ton of movies. I just don't have as much time as I used to. So, I never go to the movie theater to watch movies anymore. I just wait till they come out and I can buy them or whatnot. But, yeah, I like a lot of his films. I love the dialogue. I think more than anything, it's just very edgy and smart.
I have a confession, which is I saw Pulp Fiction for the first time 4 days ago.
Oh, my goodness.
I know, it's so disgraceful. It's one of those movies I've always pretended to watch. We do a bit on Levitard Show where I pretend like I've seen a movie and try to describe it. And it was kind of like one of those things where it was just easier to pretend I had seen it, right? Guys, I am here to tell you, Pulp Fiction is very good. You should go see it if you haven't. It is a tremendous movie. Really excellent. Question 3. Ooh. Okay, so I don't know if you saw this, but Kevin Stefanski, the new offensive coordinator of the Minnesota Vikings, that's sort of new, high school classmate of my husband, apparently nice person, husband doesn't watch football, came out and he said that, well, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he said he's been reading some articles about the relationship between establish the run and play action, and he is on the side of the nerds. So I have to ask you, Warren, how heartening is that to hear? And do you have any faith in this Vikings offense going a little bit more modern this year?
It is very heartening to hear that. I love when an offense coordinator talks about strategy and says something intelligent. So he definitely did that when he was talking about the value of of play action and how establishing the run is not required in order to get benefit of play action. That being said, I do have, you know, some concerns. It's smart that he's on that page, but you got to have your coach on that page too. And I was surprised when they hired JDF from the Philadelphia Eagles after the Eagles, you know, just completely stomped Minnesota in that 2017 season in the playoffs. And, you know, offensively threw the ball all over them. They got the quarterback coach from the Philadelphia Eagles and made him their OC. But Philadelphia is a very pass-oriented offense. They call a high rate of pass plays. And I'm not saying JDF was perfect apart from that, but it's obviously one of his underlying principles. And I'm shocked that the way Mike Zimmer seems to want to approach the offense, which is a more conservative run-based system that doesn't put our defense at risk, keeps our defense on the sidelines, you know, things that we know aren't actually beneficial towards winning games, but a defensive coordinator sometimes thinks along those lines, and it's hard to get teach an old dog new tricks from that perspective. I think he got uncomfortable with the rate that JDF was throwing the football, and so he brought in Stefanski late in the season, who I think was like the tight ends coach. And Stefanski, of course, brought with him the quarterback's coach, but Stefanski brought with him kind of like, okay, I know my marching orders. We got rid of this other guy primarily because he was throwing the ball at too high of a rate, so I know what we need to do. And they definitely changed some things late in the season once he took over, but it was only for a few weeks. So my concern is he's a smart guy, like your husband said, intelligent guy that will realize how he got his job and why his predecessor lost his job, and that's going to factor into, you know, many of the decisions that he ultimately makes from like a big picture perspective. But I hope that they utilize more play action. I hope that they, you know, don't just acquiesce to what Mike Zimmer wants to do from a, you know, total, you know, conservative approach offensively.
I mentioned this podcast, I think, a long time ago. I really stumbled across this interview with Kirk Cousin where he talked about play action and how effective it is. So I hear what you're saying about Zimmer, but it definitely feels like something's simmering in Minnesota. We'll say that. But, you know, when you have two of the best wide receivers in the NFL, you got to run the ball as much as possible. Question four. I have been standing very hard for Matt Ryan recently. I called him the most underrated quarterback in the NFL. I wanted to ask you, who do you think is an NFL quarterback who's underrated?
I won't disagree that Matt Ryan is up there.
It's subjective because, like, what is underrated really? But I guess the guy you think you're higher on than maybe other people.
I just mentioned earlier in the podcast Ben Roethlisberger, I guess. So he's a guy that I would throw into the mix as being a guy who's underrated. I think we're at an interesting point where there's a lot of, like, guys who are just, like, obviously kind of like the next gen type quarterback. Yeah. And then there's guys that are like, what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do with him? Like the Marcus Mariota guys and that category. But if I had to pull like a true underrated guy who nobody talks about as like top five, and some people actually have outside the top 10, I would throw Ben in there. He's far from perfect, let me put it that way, but he's got, I think he gets glossed over sometimes, just like Matt Ryan does.
No, I think him and Matt are kind of in that same tier category for sure. Last question, as always, comes from Lenny, my dog. And, I will do it in his... Oh, you've been on this podcast. He's asked you a question before. Warren, hear you talk a lot about passing. Hear you talk about the numbers. My question is, have you ever put your hand in the dirt? I say this as someone who rolled around in the dirt this morning. I need a bath.
That is a great question, Lenny. I played a lot of sports when I was growing up. I was never into actually playing football when I was growing up. I do not think that in any way, shape, or form impacts my ability to watch a lot of football and analyze the sport of football. And I think there are some really great analysts out there who have played football. I also think that there are some analysts out there who play football that actually it doesn't help their ability to provide analysis on games. So I don't view it as a prerequisite nor as a detriment to anybody who hasn't played it. But I know that I am as passionate about football as probably anybody that's out there analyzing the game right now. I quit my other job and do it full time. Rarely sleep. I love helping teams. Now that I've been able to be a consultant for a few teams, actually help them put their game plans together to try to win games. That's such a thrill, and it involves a lot of work, but a lot of reward. So, great question, Lenny. But the answer is I have not put my hand in the dirt.
First of all, thank you for taking my dog's question so thoughtfully. Second, as a former nose tackle, I can't really relate to your answer, but I respect it.
It's important to have mutual respect, and I'm sure you were, top of your class in nose tackles coming out of college, too.